Well, good morning. My name is Becky Payne. I am with the Division of Nutrition, Physical Activity, and Obesity at CDC, and I am distinctly privileged to follow such a wonderful opening and try to carry the momentum in what is shaping up to be a fabulous session of distinguished panelists this morning. I'm not going to spend a lot of time so we can get to what they have to share with you, but I do want to let you know that concurrent to this session is a media briefing on the release of what has been a very important project for our division, as well as the Convergence Partnership. The release of the recommended community strategies and measurements to prevent obesity in the United States. Both the companion MMWR reports and recommendation, as well as the implementation and measurement guide, are being released today. Dr. Laura Kettle Khan, who's with our division, has been the lead within our agency on that activity, and she is here in attending this conference. I encourage you to seek her out if you have questions. To set the stage just a little bit, I'd like to read the preface from that implementation guide and then kick it off to Dr. Catherine Ross. Let me start with the bios of our distinguished presenters. Dr. Catherine Ross, a nationally recognized transportation expert, is the director of Georgia Tech's Center for Quality Growth and Regional Development. Dr. Ross is also the college's first endowed faculty member, and she has held a variety of important leadership positions at Georgia Tech, including Vice Provost for Academic Affairs, Associate Vice President for Academic Affairs, Co-Director of the Transportation Research and Education Center, and Director of the College of Architecture's PhD program. Dr. Jim Salas is a professor of the Department of Psychology at San Diego State University in San Diego, California, and director of active living research. His professional accomplishments are numerous and include serving on the Common Community Measures for Obesity Select Expert Panel, the Scientific Advisory Council of the Michael and Susan Dell Center for Advancement of Healthy Living, and Coordinating Committee for the National Plan for Physical Activity. Dr. Robert Ogilvie directs Public Health Law and Policies Planning for Healthy Places Program. He has worked extensively in community development and planning to help improve low and middle income neighborhoods. And Mr. Robert Garcia is an attorney who engages, educates, and empowers communities to achieve equal access to public resources. He's the executive director, counsel, and founder of the City Project in Los Angeles, California. He's a nationally recognized leader in the urban park movement, bringing the simple joys of playing in the park to children in park-starved communities. He has helped diversify support for and access to state resource bonds with unprecedented levels of support among communities of color and low-income communities, and billions of dollars for urban parks. Now back to this resource being released today. This product is a result of an innovative and collaborative process that seeks to reverse the U.S. obesity epidemic by transforming communities into places where healthy lifestyle choices are easily incorporated into everyday life. Where we live, work, learn, worship, and play affects the choices we make and, in turn, our health. As such, the policies and environments that shape and define a community will also affect the health outcomes of its citizens. For example, communities that enact policies which increase access to affordable, healthy food options and safe opportunities for physical activity create an environment in which individuals may be more likely to adopt a healthy eating, active living lifestyle. Reversing the U.S. obesity epidemic will require population-level change that focuses on adopting policies and creating environments that support healthier lifestyle choices. Dr. Ross, would you please open up this panel? We will hold questions until the end.
Good morning. Can you hear me? Yeah? Great. Thank you for attending our session. I want to begin by reflecting on what happened at the plenary session. James Marks made comments about an event that occurred last week when representatives from the White House visited a food market, a supermarket in Philadelphia. Those representatives are affiliated direct the White House Office of Urban Affairs, Secretary or comparable to that, Adolfo Carrion. And 3 weeks ago, we had a meeting at the White House to initiate the White House of Urban Affairs. And so in addition to the departments that were referenced, we now have another ally, and I'm pleased that the first initiative out of the White House was to visit a supermarket that delivers high-quality food to low-income communities in Philadelphia. So that's the first thing that the White House of Urban Affairs has done. And as someone advising that, I'm extremely proud of that. I was glad he referenced it, and I couldn't wait to share that with you this morning. So keep that in mind. There is another opportunity for us to talk about the challenges that we confront. I get to set the national context this morning, make a brief presentation, and then relax and enjoy the presentations of everyone else to my right and my left. And what I really want to talk about, and what I've entitled my brief presentation, and we decided they were going to be brief to give us more chance to talk with you, is a tale of two cities. But really, it's a story of American cities. One of the cities I'll talk about is Atlanta, Georgia. It is one that is a strangle, a confronting over-reliance on the automobile, trying to reassert itself, if you will, to restructure its very fabric. And the project that I'm going to talk about is at the core of that. It has a population of about 500,000. It's the 30th largest city. And I'm going to contrast that with Decatur, Georgia, which is an in-town suburb of Atlanta, with a population of about 18,000, and it's a city that's focused on walkability, pedestrian activity as the hallmark for its urban structure. I think each offers a learning moment as we look at the question of how we begin to restructure our cities. One of the things that I'm going to argue for, our research we're very interested in, is this whole notion of what we call a health impact assessment. And it's important because it does what President Clinton urged us to do. It helps you answer the question of how and what are the impacts of public policies, programs that we make decisions about with no idea relative to what the impact of that project, that policy, that program might be with regard to the health of the public. So both of these cities I'm talking about were the subject of a health impact analysis. Let me just make a couple of other observations very quickly, and that is we currently, if we look at what our roadways do, our use and over-reliance on the automobile, you find that we have a number of maladies that get created. One of the things I'm going to do very quickly is to just touch on our national policies, talk a little bit about the impact on health and communities, as I said, reflect on the conduct of health impact assessments that we did for Atlanta, Georgia, and Decatur, a study in contrast, if you will, and then reach some conclusions. The challenges we confront as a result of the structure of our cities, over-reliance on automobile, I will just mention some of these. I'm not going to go over all of them. I'm sure you are aware. But ones that I will talk about is vehicle emissions, increased incidence of asthma, lung disease, cardiovascular disease, traffic crashes. We don't think of sort of traffic crashes. This is one of the most disconcerting impacts in terms of affecting our health negatively. We're talking about 42,000 deaths and 3 million injuries every year on American highways. Very significant issue in that regard. We're getting a big push because of greenhouse gases now. The whole link to greenhouse gases back to unhealthy conditions gives us another lever with which to confront the unhealthy conditions that are now the result of the transportation decisions we made and the way that we structure our cities. Cities look like they do because we've decided transportation systems are more important than people. This is one of my favorite pictures in a way, only because it, I think, really indicates the challenges that we have. This is Buford Highway in Atlanta, which previous to the construction of Interstate 85 was a major thoroughfare. We now have 85. We have a number of demographic changes. A large number of minority Hispanic families have moved in, and has the highest incidence rate of any in the state of Georgia, primarily because the environment has changed, the community has changed, but the standards for this roadway have not. And so you see people trying to cross this 8-lane facility under very threatening conditions. 50% of the money that we spend or receive by the states are based on they receive that money on the basis of how many vehicle miles you travel. So the more you travel, the more money you get. It may not be desirable to link funding to increased VMT. We may want to link funding to reductions in vehicle miles traveled. The lack of safe, convenient places and ways to walk have led to, as you know, sedentary lifestyles, a massive epidemic of obesity and chronic diseases. And I'm sharing this definition of health because I want to share with you what the city of Decatur decided its definition of health was, which is one of the things we do with health impact assessment. We engage in a thoroughgoing visioning exercise with the community. Health is a complete state of physical, mental, and social well-being and the ability to lead socially and economically productive lives. Population Atlanta. The Atlanta Beltline is the largest redevelopment project in the country now. It it's in the core, the heart of the city of Atlanta. We passed a referendum to fund it. We're going to put in $1.7 billion worth of public investment. We expect it to generate $20 billion once it's finished. And what are we going to do with this? We have 700 acres, improvements, 1,300 acres of new green space and parks. Atlanta is really far down on the green space barometer. We have very few parks. We overuse the few that we have extensively. So this is a major way to reclaim the heart of our city, infuse it with green infrastructure. Our city council has approved it. Everybody's really excited about it. When I talk about trying to struggle to restructure our city again, this is at the heart of that effort. And, of course, tremendous redevelopment with some transit. As you could imagine, there on the right you see the configuration for the Beltline itself, what it looks like. The transit stops are indicated there. It's actually funded by public monies, a tax allocation district. And the orange denotes everything that's within the tax allocation district. The broken lines are the transit system that's going to be a part of it. The project was funded for us. We did it through the Center for Quality Growth, through the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, great partners, as you know, that was referenced earlier today. And we took it, we undertook the project in concert with CDC. It's one of the first HIAs on a major transportation and redevelopment project in the country. The purpose was to make health a decision criteria for the projects that got approved. What's happening now is developers are making proposals, and we have decided that health ought to be one of the ways in which those proposals get evaluated before the city decides that, yes, we're going to allow you to develop within the Beltline. So our purpose was to make that an issue. Some of our key recommendations, there were a large number of ones. There were two I'll reference very quickly in the interest of time. One was we recommended that they put a health planner on the Tax Allocation District Advisory Committee. That's the committee that says yay or nay to developers. They have done that. We feel really happy about that. We think without the HIA. And so now every developer that comes before our city has to be vetted from a health context. The other piece that we decided that was really, really important was to have a continuing dialogue that, too, is ongoing. Very quickly to Decatur. Decatur, as I said, is a very small town in comparison to Atlanta, but really focused on scale and walkability. Their definition of health is a holistic sense of spiritual, mental, and physical well-being and the absence of illness and disease. And the spiritual caught us off guard. We had not anticipated that. But when the community got together, they decided that was what was important to them. A number of issues out of that. Let me just say two of the things that we did was to try to figure out really how large a sidewalk ought to be based on how many people are going to be using it. Okay, let me finish now very quickly. Health is a consensus builder. Let me say that. It's something we can rally people around. And we would argue that the health impact assessment is one of those tools that lets us get to how and what needs to be done, no matter whether it's a policy, a program, or a project. Thank you.
Right. Good morning, everybody. Okay. How many people from the health field do we have here today? Okay, lots and lots. How many people would you say are from a built environment kind of feel, planning, parks and rec, something like that? Okay, we got a few. Okay, and how many policy makers do we have here, or decision makers? Thanks, Martin. Okay, a couple of others. All right, very good. Well, I'm going to talk to you about designing cities for physical activity, and really relying a lot on research for this. And so if we consider the places where people are active, we think about neighborhoods. The most common activity is walking. The most common place to do it is in the neighborhood. Recreation facilities, parks and trails are very important. Transportation facilities can be set up like Buford Highway to be very dangerous for pedestrians, or can be set up to be friendly for pedestrians and cyclists. And then schools and workplaces. We spend so much time in schools and workplaces, they can be set up to be active or not. And as the point was made by President Clinton this morning, these places are all important for physical activity and health, and public health has control over none of them. We have to work with the partners and the decision makers who are in charge of making decisions about how we build our neighborhoods and whether we have rec facilities and transportation, etc., in order to achieve our goals. We're not going to get people more active, we don't believe, until these places are better for activity. Now, when we in the health field, we used to just think about exercise. But really, there are many domains of life where you can choose to be active or not. And so we use this sloth model, right? So that's a sloth up there. Sleep, we don't really have much choice about whether we're active or not in sleep. If you're a kicker, okay, you know, go ahead and do that. We don't really promote that as an activity intervention. But for leisure, occupation, transportation, and household, yes, you have a little choice. We focus mainly on leisure activity and transportation activity because we think there are more opportunities for change there. We don't think we're going to get computers out of the workplace, although we could have more activity breaks and that sort of thing in workplaces. And we don't think people are going to give up their washing machines to go back to this sort of thing. You know, I don't think that's a big winner. So the idea, though, is that you need different environments and different policies to promote active leisure and active recreation. So here's a walkable community that happens to be Manhattan, the most walkable place just about, and probably in the U.S. Mixed use. You can walk to where you need to go. The streets are connected, so you don't get lost in the cul-de-sacs, and certainly dense. Here's an alternative. A lot of people would say, well, that's walkable. It's nice. You can walk there. There's sidewalks. Yes, but there's nowhere to walk to. You can't go anywhere. You can go in a circle and get your leisure walk, and that's fine. But you can't go anywhere because it's separate use by law, by zoning code, by the laws made by your city council, or preventing the people that live in this neighborhood from walking to where they need to go. All right, so I'm going to show you a few results. This is a study that I've been involved in with the multidisciplinary team, Neighborhood Quality of Life Study. And I'm just going to show you just a few things about this. But we're interested in whether people who lived in walkable versus low walkable neighborhoods got more total physical activity. Had differences in total physical activity, and whether those benefits, hopefully, were shared by people in high and low incomes. So we studied about 2,000 people recruited from the Seattle, Washington area and the Baltimore, Washington, D.C. area. And we selected neighborhoods to fit in each of these four quadrants. And I'm just going to shoot right to the results and show you that, first of all, walkability was highly significant and that there was no walkability by income interaction, meaning that the low and high income residents got similar benefits. But if you look here in the low income, you see the bar is higher. This is total physical activity measured by accelerometers, and it's higher in the high walkable than the low walkable. And you see also in the high income, more activity in the high walkable. And this difference was about, you see, about 6 or 7 minutes a day, but that's about 35 or 45 minutes per week. And so that's getting, the people in the high walkable neighborhoods are getting one more day of meeting the 30-minute guideline. More than the low walkable residents. And we would expect this to maintain. This difference should maintain as long as people are living in those neighborhoods. And we adjusted for just about everything we could adjust for. And so if people are getting that much more activity, maybe we'd see differences in obesity, and we do see that. Again, the walkability difference in overweight and obesity was very significant. And so here you see in both the low income and the high income that obesity and overweight rates are higher in the low walkable neighborhoods. So if we take, for example, this 60% overweight and obese, that's based on self-reports, that's almost exactly what behavioral risk factor survey surveillance system says. Currently. So when was it 48%? Well, that was about 1989. So by living in a walkable neighborhood, we're, you know, in this study, we're taking off about 10 years of the obesity epidemic. All right. Now, what about kids? Does walkability make a difference for kids? Well, I think it does. This is a part of the same study. We asked parents about the walking to school of their children. And walking to school was twice as high in walkable neighborhoods versus low walkable neighborhoods. And parent concerns were really driving walking and biking to school. And those concerns were mostly about traffic. And those concerns were higher in the low walkable suburban neighborhoods, which is interesting because a lot of families move to the suburbs because they think, well, this is going to be better for my kids. And in some ways it might be, but in terms of walking for school or being concerned about traffic, low walkable was not better. And other studies show that walkable communities are better for older people as well. Here's a study. Older women who lived within walking distance of trails, parks, or stores had higher pedometer readings than women who were not. Better for kids, better for adults, better for older adults related to physical activity. All right. So if you want to design your communities for active transportation, needs to be walkable, and that means zoning code changes, and it means transportation policies that make it safer for pedestrians. Now, what about active transportation? Here's the finding from a lot of studies. People with access to park and recreation facilities are more likely to be active. All right, so if you've got a place to be active nearby, you're more likely to use it. Here's a pretty dramatic findings from a national study done by Penny Gordon Larson. Across the bottom there, this is number of facilities, recreation facilities in the neighborhood, and this includes parks and private facilities. And so the first thing you see, the pink line, the more facilities, the more active these adolescents were. The blue line, the more facilities, the less likely to be overweight and obese these adolescents were. And you see, it's just a straight line. The more facilities, the better off these kids were. A bit of good news is that recreation facilities appear to be more important for African American and Hispanic families. So if you look at the Caucasian sample here, really, it didn't make much difference if they had a lot of recreation facilities or not. But look at the African American and Hispanic neighborhoods. If they didn't have many facilities, their activity levels were very low. If they had lots of facilities, their activity levels were similar to the whites. All right, so that's the good news. The bad news is that there are disparities in access to recreation facilities. And let me just show one more thing before I close, and that is we have very low rates of bicycling in this country. And but we have some clues that this could be changed. So in Portland, they had cyclists wear GPS devices so they could tell exactly where they went. And 51% of travel miles were on streets without bicycle facilities, so dangerous places, basically. And these are 92% of all street miles. But almost 50% of bicycling miles were on streets with bicycle facilities. And so half of the bicycling was done on 8% of the streets that had protected bicycle facilities. So cyclists seek out protected bikeways. So I will just leave you with this and invite you to go to our Active Living Research website, where we have a lot of additional information on this type of research. So thank you very much.
Good morning. Thank you all for coming. I will follow up that wonderful presentation by talking about how to try and get healthy foods into neighborhoods. We heard the former president this morning talking about healthy food, and we heard Dr. Ross talking about healthy food. And I just want to put this up here. This is a picture from Modesto, California. Modesto is in the Central Valley of California, the nation's fruit basket. This is Louis Market. This was one of the neighborhood markets that went out of business, and this is a very standard situation in many parts of the country and many American neighborhoods. The healthy choice is the hard choice. I'm not going to come here and tell people today about any magic fixes, because the fact is that in the grocery store business and in the food retail business, it's a low-margin business, and there have been a lot of changes in the way American groceries are brought to market that have had an adverse impact on people, not just low-income people, have had a worse impact on low-income people. And in my shop, Public Health Law and Policy, we're out in Oakland, California, we do a lot of work with local government up and down the state of California to try and figure out ways to build new models of grocery retail that is profitable. I know a lot of our funders, and I see some of them here in the room, are really concerned about this. A lot of our funders have been funding different organizations that have been money losing, and they're very interested in trying to figure out how to create a sustainable, healthy grocery store business so that you don't see so many places like this. Or so that you don't see so many places like this. And this is just a small sample. I didn't put the big one, McDonald's, in there. Increasingly, people in America are no longer getting their food from places like this, and instead they're getting them from places like that. I understand that last year, in the teeth of the Great Recession, that's my new name for it, McDonald's profit went up by 81%. And so that's where people are going, because that's what's available. In California, where I live, the two of our partner organizations, PolicyLink and the California Center for Physical Activity, did a study which showed that there are four times as many unhealthy food retail outlets as there are healthy ones. So that's the big situation that we're dealing with. We have heard all about this. Everyone here knows about this. So these are the rates of obesity in the developed world. So that's the situation we're dealing with. We're number one, and we're trying to change that. So market forces plus public policy equal the food retail environment. I'm going to specifically today talk about two types of public policy options that are available at the local level that you all can work with to try and influence the food retail environment. One of them is economic development, and the other we've heard a little bit about already in the Atlanta context, and that's redevelopment. We heard about the Pennsylvania Fresh Food Financing Initiative already today. That's a bit of a national model. One of my staff members used to work with them, and this is one of her slides that I've borrowed, about the various things that economic development and redevelopment agencies in your town can do to try and improve the food retail environment. business attraction and retention, real estate development for dense and walkable neighborhoods. That's very important to be able to get a market, a group of buyers within distance of the grocery store. Workforce development so that you can develop a local workforce that can staff the store, and commercial district revitalization. All of these are the sorts of things that economic development and redevelopment agencies can be doing to help improve the local food retail environment. And I want to focus on the market analysis and feasibility studies. These are very, very important things that local agencies can do to help bring grocery stores to neighborhoods that the grocery retailers think might not be able to support them, but which the leakage analysis shows actually have a market there for healthy food. So let me talk about economic development. People's eyes might glaze over. Not all of you might have a master's degree in city and regional planning with a focus on economic development. I'm aware of that. So you might not know right at the tip of your tongue exactly what economic development is. Well, this is what it is. These are efforts to improve the economic well-being and quality of life for a community by creating and or retaining jobs and growing incomes and the tax base. And that is critical. In flush times, you might be able to get some of your local electeds to listen to you and think, you know, I need to be charitable. In these times, we really need to focus on this. And that's what we try to focus on, is really working with localities to understand how this can be a vibrant business model, bringing food to neighborhoods that don't have them right now. We heard about redevelopment earlier on this morning. Redevelopment is slightly different from economic development in that in cities, redevelopment agencies create districts that are called redevelopment areas. And within those redevelopment areas, they've got economic development powers, but they've also got power over land use. So it's a sort of a combo. And we heard about the is it the Beltline redevelopment area? So, you know, and there are lots of those. In most cities, in most states throughout the nation, low-income neighborhoods tend to be redevelopment areas. And so you have redevelopment agencies that have a lot of ability to do some of this work. I'm not saying they're all doing this work right now, but with proper advocacy, I'm optimistic that a lot of redevelopment agencies can be turned around. So rather than just building new NFL stadiums, not that there's anything wrong with the NFL, they can build grocery stores as well. Redevelopment agencies are specifically supposed to get rid of blight. In many states, what blight is defined in the Health and Safety Code. And in California, blight includes this language, dilapidated buildings, abandonment of buildings, concentrated economic inactivity, including a lack of grocery stores. So let me speed through. So what sort of incentives can be put out there by local government agencies to support healthy retail? I mentioned conducting feasibility studies or market analyses. This is the farmers market in Sacramento, which is Sacramento, California. It's thriving right now. At first it wasn't, but the local economic development agency helped them, through market analysis, understand how they could sort of change their offerings so that it would appeal more to the local clientele. And as of last summer, they were at break even. I'm waiting to see the statistics for this summer. Years before, they'd been losing a lot of money. Economic development agencies can help businesses take risks. This is one in San Francisco, in the South of Market redevelopment area, City Produce, which the economic development agency worked with to help them bring in refrigeration units, display units for healthy food. Something that people don't understand, selling junk food in a grocery store like this or a store like this is a no-brainer. The Frito-Lay guy brings in the display case. He comes every month and stocks it, and as a store owner, you have to do nothing except ka-ching. It's very, very different when you're selling healthy food. It requires a lot more sort of effort and thinking and business management on your part. We're starting to see city economic development agencies work with grocery store owners to help them learn how to do that. And then public funding sources can be used to finance complex development projects. Grocery store developments are complex finance developments. The average size of an American grocery store has grown greatly like the average size of everything else American has grown greatly in the last couple decades, and increasingly they're very big and complex real estate deals involving parking, land acquisition. Local economic development agencies and redevelopment agencies can get involved and are getting involved in that. Okay, just other local government agencies that are out there that can help bring healthy food to the neighborhood, community development corporations, small business assistant, nonprofit, job training, placement agencies, and business associations. And if you didn't understand already, just to drive home the point that local land use and economic development decisions have multiple health implications. My organization has put out a lot of tools to help you understand how to do this, and we're available free on the web, healthyplanning.org. Thank you.
My name is Robert Garcia. I'm executive director and counsel of the City Project. We are a nonprofit policy and legal advocacy organization. I am an attorney. I'm a recovering litigator. And I've been asked to speak about the law and the opportunities for social change through law and enforcing and creating policy change through law, including the possibility of litigation. I'm going to talk about schools, parks, stimulus funding, and justice, equal justice. This is a photograph from the LA Times taken during the midst of a campaign to open a brand new Olympic-sized swimming pool and high school to the public after school and on weekends. That is the Miguel Contreras Learning Center. It is in Pico Union, downtown LA, where I grew up, about three blocks from our offices. $180 million school, and when it opened in the most park-poor assembly district in the state of California, park-poor, and also no school fields for use for physical activity, the pool was closed after school and on weekends and during the summer. And working with ACORN and the community in a one-year media campaign, we ultimately persuaded the school district and City Rec and Parks to work together to open that school open that pool after school and on weekends. And this has important implications for the joint use of pools, schools, and parks throughout Los Angeles, throughout the state of California, throughout the nation. I think that used to be the standard, that schools were open after school and on weekends everywhere. And today it's the opposite. They're locked up with fences like that separating neighborhood children, particularly in underserved communities, from football fields, soccer fields, baseball diamonds, basketball courts, swimming pools. And joint use, I believe, is one of the main issues that the Convergence Project, including the Endowment, California Endowment, Kaiser Permanente, Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, have focused on. And this is a best practice example. It went from being a worst practice example to a best practice example. Because as a result of the campaign, Los Angeles Unified School District, the second largest in the nation, and the Parks and Recreation Department opened not only this pool, but also signed a master joint use agreement for 15 other schools, pools, and parks in public schools and throughout LA, which is good news. However, there are 600 public schools in LA and only about 45 joint use agreements. But that is a success story. And I use the images and not the words because you won't remember what I say tomorrow, but in a year, and maybe several years from now, you will remember this image and what it represents, a little girl of color looking through a locked fence at a public school that she cannot use. First of all. Second, a related school victory is that we have been working with the Los Angeles Unified School District to enforce physical education laws requiring 20 minutes of physical education in elementary schools on average every day and 40 minutes in middle schools and high schools. And this is not just good policy. It's good law. It is the law. But throughout California in 2006, Over half of the school districts did not enforce physical education laws. And we've been working with the teachers union, United Teachers of Los Angeles, and a public campaign. First of all, the teachers union has organized public support to enforce physical education laws. Second, we filed administrative complaints, both on the grounds that the physical education laws were not being enforced, and very importantly, on the civil rights laws, which prohibit both intentional discrimination and, more importantly, unjustified discriminatory impacts based on race, color, or national origin. Third, we persuaded the school board to adopt a resolution requiring enforcement of the physical education laws and the civil rights laws. Fourth, we are working on an implementation plan to enforce those laws. And I thought the implementation plan would be a simple memo from the superintendent to every principal saying, enforce the physical education laws, have your teachers go out and teach PE 20 minutes every day in elementary school and 40 minutes every day in middle and high schools. In fact, it's taken us about a year, and we're hoping the implementation plan will come out within the next week or two. But today, on our blog post at www.cityprojectca.org, we have a policy brief announcing that LAUSD has adopted, for the first time ever, a policy statement that physical education laws must be enforced both under the physical education laws and the civil rights laws. That's a major victory for the physical education campaign. Thank you. And for the civil rights campaign. And I had hoped to have copied that policy statement here today, but I finished it at 3 in the morning, so I didn't have a chance to Xerox it. But it's on our website today in our most recent blog post. Parks. Because the two most important social institutions to provide places for physical activity and healthy eating in our society, particularly in underserved communities, are schools and parks. And the analysis by the City Project has shown that children of color living in poverty with no access to a park have the worst access to parks, the worst access to schools of playing fields of 5 acres or more, the worst access to transportation because they can't afford cars and there are no decent transit systems in LA, and the highest levels of child obesity. And we also extended that statewide. This map is the first time the state of California has been mapped at the census tract level to show access to green space based on race, ethnicity, income, demographics, salient demographic factors. And we actually worked with the legislature last year to define criteria for investing a particular pot of $400 million in park funds so that those funds are invested, one, in park-poor communities, and two, income-poor communities. And it's defined by legislation as park-poor being less than 3 acres of parks per 1,000 residents, and income-poor is below $48,000 per year annual median household income. The red hotspots are the combination of those two, and that's where not only that particular pot of money should be invested, but as President Clinton pointed out today, where economic stimulus funds should be invested. And we, by coincidence or not, have published a study, a policy report, on economic stimulus, green space, and equal justice. It's also available on our website on that very issue. And what is important about this legislation is that it establishes standards to measure progress and equity and to hold public officials accountable. That is the map of Los Angeles. The red hotspots, as I say, are where children of color living in poverty with no access to a car have the worst access to parks, the worst access to schools with playing fields of 5 acres or more, the highest levels of child obesity, and no access to decent transportation. County of LA did a similar map based solely on obesity and access to parks and economic factors. They're pretty much the same. The County of LA ignored the disparities based on race and ethnicity. And we ask ourselves, why is that? And it may very well be because there are laws against discriminatory impacts based on race and ethnicity, but no laws against disparities based on income. So the County of Los Angeles does not want to expose other government agencies to liability under the civil rights laws, so they ignore the civil rights data. But we don't. We map it, we analyze it, we bring lawsuits when we have to. This is our pilot, our flagship project. In 2000, the city of LA and a wealthy developer wanted to put warehouses in the last vast open space in downtown LA. And we tried working through the planning process to create a park there instead, but ultimately we had to file a lawsuit, and today that is the Los Angeles State Historic Park. The Los Angeles Times called that a heroic monument and a symbol of hope. We achieved a similar victory along the Los Angeles River. That big rectangular area there, which was an abandoned train yard, now provides both active recreation and passive recreation for the children in one of the most park-starved areas of Los Angeles. You can find more information about this here. In conclusion, because my time is up, I am a lawyer, but we do not choose litigation as the first avenue. What we have learned is, number one, the need to build coalitions. And right now, the state of California, up until last week, was proposing closing 220 state parks, 1.2 million acres of state parks. We've knocked it down so far to 50 state parks. And we did that through an alliance that includes the health community, putting health front and center in the closure of state parks. Two, multidisciplinary research and analysis. We work with people like the California Endowment, Dr. Jim Salas, using the empirical research on physical activity and access to parks to support our claims, both as a policy matter outside of court and in litigation in court. Third, multimedia campaigns, strategic media campaigns, traditionally including print media, but more and more including social media, Facebook, Twitter, and so on. Fourth, we do engage in advocacy outside of court. That's our preferred route through the planning process. But fifth, we do go to court when we have to. We don't call it litigation because foundations don't fund litigation. We call it access to justice through the courts. And we are very thankful to the California Endowment, the Gilbert Foundation, Kaiser Permanente for making our work possible in this area. Thank you very much.
Thank you for wonderful discussions about the power of community engagement and policy options for restructuring our cities. We have time for some questions.
Hello, my name is Gary Deverman. I'm Chief Executive Officer for Building Healthier America. I just wanted to have you guys comment on what seems to be a dichotomy, and that is the erosion of funding for public health. A board member of mine is the Terry Mason Commissioner of Health in Chicago. They just laid off 400 public health workers. State of Illinois just laid off 1,600 more. Can you comment on the dichotomy that's taking place where public health is losing capacity all the while we're trying to build up all the stimulus and all that?
You know, it's happening all across the country, and that's, I think, symptomatic of the economy we're in. One of the things that I do when I work with public health departments is stress the same sort of thing that Robert just spoke about, Robert Garcia, that is, which is the importance of building collaboration with other agencies so that you can get your work done that way. We heard that in Atlanta you've got public health people on the oversight committee for their tax allocation district. We're working on doing a lot of that in California as well. And I think it's a very sad situation where people are being laid off to the extent that they are. And I think we have no option really but now to work to build interdisciplinary collaborations to get the stuff done. That's the approach that we take in our work.
Maybe just one comment. It is a shame, no question about that. You know, I guess one of the things that I would suggest as a way to move forward is for the public health systems to have a better contact with the public. You know, I think a lot of people don't understand what the public health system does and all the different aspects of their life. And so having a better dialogue, reaching out to more community groups, I think might build support so that we could prevent further erosion in public health infrastructure, sort of what Robert Garcia suggested about, you know, action to keep all the parks from closing in California.
Hello, my name is Dr. Robert Gilio. I'm with the Student Health Force program, doing work in New Orleans and working with Building a Healthier Chicago. An observation I had, and I think a question maybe to Dr. Ogilvie, is collaboration is something that we're seeing being very helpful, where the schools, the students in the schools, is a way of bringing people to cooperate and break down the silos. We're training students to be health advocates for themselves, working within their built environment to do the best they can in that food desert or in that across the street from the beautiful park that their parents don't let them play in because they'll get shot there. The park is wide open and it's beautiful and beautifully landscaped. But the Student Health Force, one of the mechanisms we're studying, and I'm curious if you have any experience or anyone in the room with experience in the nation, of using the school's built structure itself as a distribution point for food dissemination. When our kids learn, they learn and earn vegetables or fruit. And so if they study and they learn what they need to do for their own health advocacy, they're earning the rights to bring home those groceries to their parents. Has anyone set up a sustainable for-profit or for-service mechanism using the built structure of the schools or the church as a mechanism to address food deserts in a city? I'm wondering if any of you have knowledge of that. I'd be very interested in that.
So Robert Garcia just whispered in my ear that there's been talk of using school parking lots in the LA Unified School District for food distribution. I know there are a couple of my program officers from Kaiser Permanente here in the room, and Kaiser Permanente, at least in Northern California, I can speak to that, has done a great job, in effect, building their own food distribution system and having farmers markets and healthy food, farmers markets on site that serve their employees and others in the neighborhood. One of the things we're also working on to, again, hit the point of collaboration with Robert and with, I see Martin Gonzalez from the California School Boards Association in the back. He just raised his hand, not nearly high enough so that everyone can see. There he is. To try and get joint use agreements. Robert spoke about joint use agreements. To get those written throughout the state and implemented and enforced and observed and part of the culture. Because schools are public facilities that we all pay for. And while many low-income neighborhoods don't have adequate recreation facilities, they all do have schools. And so while I'm not the expert on that particular issue, I do know that there's a whole movement nationwide to have school facilities used more broadly and to have them as community centers, which is in effect what you're talking about.
Doralina Sammons, Posey, New Jersey. I have a question for Dr. Ross. It's a three-part question. What is the timetable for the Atlanta Beltline project? How much funding was put in by Robert Wood Johnson Foundation? And I didn't quite get the tie-in with the Decatur and the Beltline project.
Okay. Well, let me start with the third question first. The tie-in is that both of them were conducted using what we call a fairly new technique in the United States. It's called health impact assessment. Decatur was about to do a regular transportation plan, and we said, oh, no, let's do something that we call a community transportation plan. Let's integrate health. Let's look at actually creating more cycling, more pedestrian ways. Let's measure that. Let's figure out how wide sidewalks should be. 6 feet doesn't always work. Neither does eight. And let's integrate that with any improvements. What's happened subsequent to that, and same thing with the Beltline, so we did analysis. Let me give you two quick examples in each. What happened with Decatur is they subsequently hired a health planner on their staff regularly. The mayor got all excited. He's a wellness commission now, which is wonderful, and they've gotten awards for that, all because health became the focus of a common, everybody does transportation plans every 3 to 5 years. and health is never a part of it. So for the first time we did it. We only did that because of health impact assessment. With the Beltline health impact assessment, what we did was we put up not only cost benefit analysis of a project, what's the health impact of a project? We did forecasts that indicates our mayor set up parks, green space per 1,000. We set up a forecast that says we hit the number for now through 2015, and 2018 we're off again, which means you got to put more money in parks or you don't hit it. That only became possible because of a health impact assessment. As I said, someone on there who actually has a health background, and HIA, health impact assessment, is one of the criteria they use for evaluating all projects. That's the connection. The Beltline is probably over the next 15 years or so, it'll be completely built out. As I said, 1.5 in, about 20 billion out. But the message really is, everywhere in America, we are redeveloping our cities. There's no reason why the city planning, the regional planning commission doesn't answer the question, what is the impact of health on widening that road, closing that intersection, closing that school? So we really have a chance to restructure our cities, no matter where you are, making health a part of the public debate.
Could I just add something? The Southern California Association of Governments, which has jurisdiction over five or six counties in Southern California, this year, as part of their regional transportation plan, included a chapter on environmental justice, and the focus of that chapter was access to parks as part of the transportation planning. And it's one of the slides I skipped over. It demonstrates that for the population in the lowest 20% income bracket, they have no access to green space. And the SCAG, the Southern California Association of Governments, as part of its regional transportation plan process, calls for a multi-agency effort to provide transportation to parks as a matter of equal justice for all.
Hi, Mark Fenton from the Boston area. A short answer to the gentleman's previous question. I've worked with a couple of YMCAs across the country that have successfully become essentially virtual farmers markets, where families with kids there in after-school programs and so on can make orders and pick up. Maui, Pittsburgh, Springfield, Missouri come to mind as three Ys that have done that. But my question was actually a direct follow-up to the dialogue that was just going on here. So here we are talking about the role of planning and so on. Jim asked the question at the beginning, how many of you are here from the built environment world or are policymakers? I raised my hand because I serve on my local planning board, which happens to be an elected position in my community. Four hands went up. My question is this. We're talking about good successes, and I would argue even the planning community, if we had a room full of planners, would mostly nod their heads. Yes, walkable communities, better transit, wider sidewalks. Policymakers, elected officials and appointed officials at the local area, at the local level. So I'm talking city councilors and our planning commissioners that often give the thumbs up or thumbs down to a new development, may be the biggest barrier, or at least the group that doesn't get this the most. And so my question to you guys is, how do we get them in the game? How is half of this room, next time we do this, full of the people that are really at the sort of the nexus point, I would argue, more so even than the professionals, but maybe the transportation engineering world, you could say as well. We got to make that connection. How do we get there?
I'll take a quick stab at it, and then someone else may want to make a comment. One of the things that we did was to drag the city council. We did a presentation before the Atlanta City Council on health impact assessment, again, looking at access to parks, green space, health disparities in different sections of the city. The Southwest Quadrant is the poorest. They have most health challenges, and when this is done, they're still going to be the poorest and still have the most health challenges and still have the least amount of access to green parks, to green space. So one of our contributions was to say to them, if in fact we're recapturing our city, casting for and creating more green space, let's make sure that people who need it the most end up in a situation where they're better off. That only came because we did a presentation before them, and they really have adopted HIA. As just like cost benefit, it's one of their ways to evaluate it. So educating them, exposing them, we made them come to community meetings. It was election, they all came. You have to really put it in front of them and make them deal with the issues that are on the table.
Thanks, Mark. There's a lot of public health people here. How many of you have testified before your city council, educated elected official about built environment and health? Well, I think there's a lot of you that have not. Thanks to you, thanks to those of you that have. My first foray into this was a walkable community was proposed in the San Diego region. I was asked to come talk about the connection with health, and I got a lot of very puzzled looks from my city council. Oh, what are you talking about? We're talking about development here. And so there's a lot of education that needs to be done, but each of us can do that. And either in a public testimony or private sessions with city council staff and others. And so we need to speak up. They're not going to absorb this from the air. It's up to us.
I just want to add something quickly. I find that when you're trying to build alliances with whoever, you've got to talk to their base interest. Showing public health data to elected officials so they can understand what's going on with their constituency is extremely important. But I think something even more important is to help elected officials that understand that all types of development are not necessarily good for the city's bottom line. At the beginning of April, Paris Glendening, former governor of Maryland, and I'm sure lots of you have heard him speak because he speaks everywhere, was at the California Redevelopment Association, and he cited a study from this part of the country that shows that low-density sprawl development loses money for municipalities. And what I mean by that is the amount of taxes and revenues they collect in the place is not enough to pay for the installation and the upkeep of the infrastructure. There are too few people and too little business going on per acre to have enough revenue coming in to make it a moneymaker. And local electeds don't necessarily understand that. They think that, oh, you know, a developer is coming here. Oh, boy, I might not get asked to the prom again. I got to say yes. And we need to come with the research to help them understand that some types of development, especially the unhealthy low-density development that we don't like, is actually a money loser for their locality. Once they start to understand that, I think people, the local electeds, will really start to think and behave differently.
I'd also like to emphasize that health professionals, in my experience, reduce health to a question of obesity and diabetes, and it's broader than that, and you can diversify the alliance by focusing on related aspects of health. The fact that places for physical activity in parks and schools, for example, physically fit students do better academically, one. Two, they stay in school longer if they have things to do like sports after school. Also, places for physical activity in parks and schools provide alternatives to gangs, crime, drugs, and violence. So if you rethink what it means to have parks and schools to promote health, it's not just about obesity and diabetes, as important as that is. It's about, as the City Project focuses, helping students move more, eat well, stay healthy, and do their best in school and in life.
Thank you. Unfortunately, that's going to have to be the last question. So thank you to all of our panelists for a wonderful discussion.